Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussions, news, and interviews presenting the film scene with Ileana Douglas. Ileana is an actress, writer, author, and film historian with a need to discuss movies that borders on obsession. You'll learn the history of movies one great story at a time. The film scene is the deep cuts of movie podcasts featuring movies we love by the people who made them. And now, Ileana Douglas.
Hello, everyone.
Here we are.
Welcome to the film scene. I'd like to introduce my co-host, Jeff Graham. Jeff was a producer of our show, and I must say, usually we would end the show and continue the discussion over homemade peanut butter guacamole outside.
Yes, I weaseled my way onto the show. I was producing it for a while, and Ileana and I are really excited to come back. If you are a fan of the Dennis Hopper podcast, this is a continuation of the show. Think of it as a revitalization of what we already had. So we're super excited to be back. It's what you already love, plus more.
But we just wanted to take the show in a new direction, and we've got such a backlog, obviously, of great guests that people can always go to the site and re-listen to the shows that we have. But we want to start doing more things that are, I don't know, just more personally fun for me, top 10 lists and deep cuts, and have returning guests to do, talk more about their career, maybe one film or more current movies, all of the above, and even going around the country, which is something I've been doing. A couple things I've been doing lately, a lot of commentary on films and also traveling around the country.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have, obviously you're an amazing interviewer, but you're also this brilliant film scholar. So what we want to do is design the show to not only include interviews, but top 10 lists, like you mentioned, career retrospectives of directors that we love. We're sort of planning our schedule right now around the holidays. So we just are really excited about the potential of this relaunch. And again, we have the backlog of episodes to listen to, but we have so many more in store for you guys.
And the last thing I want to add is just including the fans more, because I'm such a film fan. Like, I'm a fanatic. You could, you know, stop me on the street and always get me with talking about some obscure film. So I love including the fans more and incorporating, you know, some of their thoughts about subjects they'd like to hear, movies they'd like to hear more of. I'm totally up for that. So a couple things this week. We were inspired to do a top 10 list of Hollywood films because of the fantastic movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I thought that Paul Sada would be a fantastic guest as the writer of Sandy Wexler, which I feel like is a little bit of a gem of a film that not too many people know about. And I'll tell a little story about when I'm on the air, but I actually had never seen the movie until this weekend. I was blown away. I love this film. It almost made my top 10 list. That's how good it is. And the other thing I want to say, just with our reboot, which is so interesting, the last show, which was called I Blame Dennis Hopper, and here we are. I just want to talk a little bit about Peter Fonda, who passed away, played a major role, you know, in my life, obviously, with the film Easy Rider. But I was lucky enough, he was cast on a film I did called Grace of My Heart. And he was so gracious that he showed up to do the movie. We had a last-minute cancellation. Mick Fleetwood actually was supposed to be in the movie. He couldn't. But Bridget Fonda was in the film, and she asked her dad if he would come by. And he came by and said to play my guru in the film. And unfortunately, the scene was later cut, which is too bad. You can blame Martin Scorsese for that, for our producer. But he didn't like the scene. But we loved it. We thought it was great. And when Allison was thanking him when we were done shooting, he said, "Oh, no problem. I always, I'm always up for free food." And he said, "No," we thought he was kidding. And he said, "No, I'm serious." He goes, "The whole time I'm in LA, if ever I see a movie set, I just pull up and I grab a tray and I stand in line. And people say, 'Oh my God, I didn't know Peter Fonda was in this movie.'" And he gets his free food.
But just looking for crafty.
Yeah. But he had that kind of attitude, just so much fun, so humble. And I think that, you know, what Peter Fonda represented, I used to see him all the time at some of these Academy luncheons. And he just was one of those touchstones in Hollywood that they really, and I said this before on Twitter, you know, Easy Rider for me, although there are lots of forerunners, and this is what's fun about the show. Mm-hmm. I love when people argue with me. But for me, Easy Rider is really, independent film begins with Easy Rider. It was made for about $400,000.
Yeah.
It made $60 million in the original, you know, release, went on to win all sorts of Academy Awards. And you could talk about John Cassavetes being a forerunner, obviously, of independent film. There's many other people, Shirley Clark, all sorts of people were making independent films, Andy Warhol. But for me, Easy Rider is basically was an independent film that became a studio film,
yeah,
that became a model, you know, for giving the keys to the kingdom to people like Spielberg and Corman and De Palma and Marty and the rest.
Yeah, I think what Easy Rider did with music, too, is like so, yes, hugely influential. When you look at, especially with indies, I feel like so often music is sort of the lifeblood of what makes a great indie film. And Easy, yeah, Rider, I agree, is such an important precedent for like establishing that, I think.
And other great films that he's been in, a lot of people have talked about The Hired Hand. Mm. One of his early films, which I really like, is called Lilith.
I've never seen that. I need to.
Yeah, that's a very good film. And everyone, I think, also references The Limey. Mm. He's incredible.
I think of the 310 to Yuma remake. That's funny. That's my,
yes,
reference. Because that was actually a great remake.
Yeah.
I like both, but he was so good in that movie. And that just the Fonda family in general, you know, like you mentioned, just such an important component to the DNA of Hollywood. You know?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And he was, you know, Captain America in that movie. And I don't know. It's just a touchstone for me. And it was so amazing to see all the references for him in terms of what he contributed to cinema. But, you know, he represented, as that movie represented, freedom, artistic freedom, independent film freedom. Mm. And so I think to that we'll all, you know, we will always owe him a debt to gratitude. So God
we
bless
do have,
you, Peter.
Some people watching along too who,
sure,
are loving,
absolutely,
Peter. We have Sandwich in here saying, RIP Peter Fonda, you are a legend in Hollywood. Also saying, Ileana looks lovely in green today. So,
oh, well, thank you.
If you guys are listening on the podcast, we do want to let you know that we go live on Thursdays at 3 p.m. and you can,
yeah,
tune in and join the conversation with us.
Yeah, please do.
So, right now we have Frank Wells and Sandwich and a bunch of people in the chat. So, thanks for joining in. And when Paul is on air later in the show, ask some questions and we'll send them his way.
Oh, my God. Okay, we're going to bring Paul in a second, and we're going to be talking about the film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Mm. First reaction.
I loved it.
Me too.
I love Tarantino, and like you mentioned, you have to get on board with the fact that he's going to play by his own rules.
Yes.
But there's something about Tarantino, too, where even though he's bending the rules and, again, establishing his own voice, he makes very likable, mainstream-feeling movies. You,
yeah,
know, he kind of makes these populist movies with indie undertones. It's a really interesting mix. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, if you ever want to talk about a director being passionate and rendering that passion on screen, that's what that movie does. It's such a love letter.
I think so, too. And it was inspiring for me. And just to do the kind of movie that is in your heart and not, don't listen to other people. Mm. And that's when I saw that movie. You know, like Jerry Lewis used to always say, he had a love affair with emulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Tarantino has that same, you feel the love from that film, and every performance I think is just incredible. Okay, I'm so excited. I want to bring Paul in because,
yes,
I'm dying to, so many movies that didn't make my list, but that people wrote to me on Twitter. So let's bring in Paul because I'm so excited about this. Screenwriter and director Paul Sato was born in Brooklyn, but he was raised in Queens. That's our first tie-in. I spent a lot of time in Queens when I was a kid. He began his career as an actor. He appeared alongside Kevin Hart. He co-wrote, produced, and starred in his first movie. As I said, it was a privilege to watch all his movies this weekend. I could not find The Undeserved. Whoever is distributing that movie, get it out there. And he consulted on Tom McCarthy's movie Win-Win, starring Paul Giamatti. And he co-wrote, listen to this, The Cobbler, starring Adam Sandler, Dustin Hoffman, and Steve Buscemi. Co-producer, fantastic special on Adam Sandler's 100% Fresh, and co-wrote that with Dan Bula, and a co-producer screenplay of Sandy Wexler, also acted in it. We're going to get to that. And co-producer of The Do-Over, which is the Adam and and David Spade movie, and an associate producer didn't make the cut, I guess, for the acting of Ridiculous Six, which I also loved. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Sado, thanks so much. Hey. Paul, thanks so much for doing this. Yes, I can hear you.
Great.
Okay, well, thanks for being on the show, first off.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited.
Now, what did you think? What did you think of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I really loved it. To me, it was such a joy just to have two things going at the same time. One, mm-hmm. it was this very sort of, like you said, independent spirit, and very there was all this youthful kind of energy, and a guy just breaking all the rules, doing whatever he wants. But simultaneously, he's a master storyteller. So it's like reading, it almost reminds me of like those late period John Huston movies, or those late period Coppola movies, mm-hmm. where they just kind of start making these weirdo movies where they're doing whatever they want to do, but they can't not be masters of their craft. Do you know what I mean?
I felt the same way even about Brad Pitt, you know? I mean, just as an actor myself, he was so confident to lay back and mm-hmm. play the bass. Well, you know, DiCaprio, because it's so tempting, you know, when you're an actor and you're in a scene, you see people, they're going all over the place and you kind of want to match them. And it's hard to, you got to do your own thing, you know, play the bass line.
Yeah, you're right. There was kind of like a jazz combo aspect to it. No, it wasn't Leo versus Brad, two guys trying to win the scene. They were
right,
really
exactly.
other, and yeah, it was really and you know, it's a really beautiful perspective on the history of Hollywood and what's poetic about it and what's romantic about it, and also what's real about it without getting terribly dark. I was really moved by his by the way he sort of wove together his fantasy with sort of the edges of, you know, what we know to be the reality of that town. I don't know.
Right.
I just thought it was really gorgeous.
Yeah, I love, and you know, and I think, you remember what I was saying, it just sort of revitalized my love of making movies, you know?
Right.
And the idea that there's spoilers in it and we're all playing along and we're not talking about the, you know, I love that. It's like, that's sort of the fun of going to see the movies, you know, that it, we, you know, gives us something all to talk about. I was going to ask you, do you remember your first experience coming to Hollywood, and what was that like? And
yeah, because I, you know, I was in New York, for a very long time. So I mean, my first trip out, I had written a movie for, it was one of my first kind of sort of bootleg screenwriting jobs. I got paid like $2,000 to write this script back when rappers were getting a lot of money to make these movies. So I got like some weird like backdoor cash to write a movie for the group Mobb Deep.
Uh-huh.
And, my idea was like, oh, we're going to make like a Richard Lester movie with rappers in it. or like Blake Edwards. I wanted to make like the Great Race, The Amazing Race.
With, yeah.
You know, those guys. But I ended up coming out to like L.A. and staying at the Highland Franklin Suites and shooting in the L.A. River and not getting paid. And it was, you know, that was my first real experience in L.A., which was really, I was young and excited to be there. And then I didn't move out there. I'm in New York right now, but I live in LA, and I didn't move out there until about 5-6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That sounds like my experience too.
Mm.
Yeah.
I was at the Oakwood Apartments.
Oh, classic.
Yeah. That was the, you know, the other thing is, I don't know if you ever had this experience, but, you know, they would fly back when show business was fun and there was lots of money. They would fly you out for pilot. Like, the three, you'd be up against two other people and they'd be on the plane with you.
Scoping each other out.
And we'd all check into the Universal.
Yes.
Sheridan.
And you'd probably stay at the Oakland.
Who were the two that you used to go up against all the time?
Oh, God. I'm trying to think. There was, it was usually like the, you know, I was in the Joan Cusack, Marissa Tomei kind of vein. But one time there was a pilot and it was called Supergirl. And it was like two blonde girls. And I was clearly the wacky choice. I was the wacky choice a lot of times, you know.
And one of the weird sort of totems of Sandy Wexler, not to jump the gun, but you did, like, for me, there's 5 minutes of television that you did that I think is the definitive comment on Hollywood. And it's that bit at the end of the Larry Sanders Show where you're dating him. He's coaching you to do your shot on his show.
Yeah.
You do the shot, and then it's that scene where you tell him, if I hadn't done so well, I don't think that you would like me anymore. And he says, you know, I'm all fucked up, or I don't know.
Yeah, that's what he says. That. Yeah.
But then the turn of you then hugging him and then saying, but was I good? And all those layers, and it's about 4.5 minutes. And to me, it's like, that's the sort of purity, you know, injected into all the other weird psychological stuff that brings us out there. You know, the curse of having talent or whatever it is. I don't know. It's just, there's so much in that moment that to me is like, you know.
Yeah, that was an interesting, that whole experience, obviously, working with Gary Shandling was life-changing. And that was the first time that I sat with Gary and he said, just tell me every funny thing that ever happened to you. Hmm. And we just sat for like 2 days. And that's the first time. I mean, you're an actor who became a writer. I just was one of those people like, wait a minute. I just think I'm funny and I ad lib every now and then. But he was like, no, you're a writer. You should write. You should do more things. And he really gave me confidence in terms of all those scenes, you know, because a lot of it was improv'd. But you must,
yeah, that's in particular, because there's all those, you want to be very organic and real within the context of the scene, but there's those specific beats you had to hit of like, I feel like there's a phoniness here. Okay, now that we've solved that, I need the validation that you were giving me before. And
right.
Once you get that, then he's satiated. Now he needs the validation from you. And you come together, such a... It's a math to it. It needs to be precise, but also jangly, and that's great.
Yes, I've certainly lived that scene too. In certain relationships, but we'll get to that on the next. It's only the first episode.
Yes, we'll save that.
So, Paul, I want to run down. These are some of the movies that didn't make my list that I just from fans that shouted out on Twitter. Rules Don't Apply, which was the Warren Beatty movie.
I loved it. Really loved it.
Yeah, The Big Picture. A lot of people, this Kevin Bacon movie, Michael McKean is in this. Last of Sheila, that came from Michael McKean himself.
They're all on a boat, right?
Yeah, I know. Well, everybody's got their own, you know, that's what I love about Top 10. It's so subjective, you know, you can argue it out.
Rules don't apply.
Yeah. Day of the Locust, that was too dark for me.
Yeah, not my favorite.
Inside Daisy Clover. Okay, here's a good one. I bet you've never heard of this. There's only two people in the world who are obsessed with this movie. One of them is named Martin Scorsese. It's The Legend of Lila Clare. The other one is my friend Peter Avellino. And we always fight about it. I think it's one of the worst movies ever made. Being in a relationship with Marty, he's like, no, maybe if I show it to you one more time, you'll understand that it's a great movie. It's Robert Aldrich, Kim Novak, That's another thing too, Paul. Like, is there a certain aspect of Hollywood movies? Like, there's some that are so, that are like, you love to hate. All the worst good, bad movies seem to be about Hollywood.
Well, there's, for me, when I was trying to make my list, it was like, I kind of wanted to keep it on the pro, not con side of things.
Yes, me too. Like, me too.
I love Straight Time and Barfly and Killer of Sheep. You know, I mean, I love the movies that depict like the out, like the outliers of Los Angeles and what happens to people, you know, in a town like that who aren't going to become, you know, Rick Dalton. Or even Rick Dalton, you know, after the fall, you know, like Eddie Bunker in Straight Time is just trying to make it happen out there in the valley. You know, so I love movies like that. But I tried to keep my list in the realm of, for the most part, in the realm of, you know, pro this sort of, you know, poetic and fantastical life we get to participate in. You know, as people in show business.
I agree. And it was funny when I was doing the list, what it made me realize how many times, because I love movies about show business. And how many times have you as a writer, I know it's happened to me, have you, how many times have you pitched things and they go, yeah, it's a little bit too inside baseball. People don't like movies about show business. Here's how many, like, and
wow.
It's like endless. There's, what I was doing, I was like, okay, there's endlessly, there's more movies about show business than there are about baseball.
Yeah. It's true. It,
honestly, like any time I pitch anything and I get a definitive, and I get anything definitive that isn't a yes, I then immediately see something way to the extreme. You know, like I'll pitch something and they go, well, that's too dark. And then I'll go home and there's like a dead baby on Law and Order. Like, I didn't have a dead baby in it. I mean, this thing is on ABC at primetime. Like, you know, like they always... You know, it's everybody should just say yes or shut up, or it's kind of how I feel about it.
Well, that leads me a little bit to Sandy Wexler. Was that something that came from your wheelhouse or Adam's? I was so impressed with this movie, and I have to say I was kind of surprised that it's not more well-known, or is it well-known, and I'm just too busy watching other things.
It definitely... was sort of elevated critically out of the sort of muck of what Adam's movies usually, you know, get filed under.
Right.
You know, I think the press has a problem with him just in terms of, like, he succeeds despite them.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I think they're not his friend. But Adam and I... we're kind of talking about, well, you know, Adam's manager is Sandy Wernick at Brillstein. Mm-hmm. And Sandy Wernick is one of the sort of OG managers. He was Bernie Brillstein's kind of protege, and he did all the deals on, you know, at the beginning of Saturday Night Live and the Muppets, and did that huge deal on Friends. I mean, he's kind of that guy.
Uh-huh.
And he represents Evel Knievel. He's just... And he talks like this. I mean, this is sort of how Sandy talks. And he always, you know, I thought you said you were going to be there. That's all kind of from him. And we were talking about what could we do with a character like that. And then, you know, I had just come out to L.A. And, you know, my experience out there was very, it was kind of like, this is the big show, you know what I mean? And as cynical as you might want to be about it, it really is people just exerting everything they have spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, physically, financially to attain this kind of indescribable thing, you know, that they hope will validate them or elevate them or whatever it is. And so it became, okay, well, can we tell an aspirational story about kind of a lovable, you know, quote unquote loser who doesn't have talent of his own? His talent is facilitating talent, but his eye is toward like authenticity, not necessarily stardom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then my thought was, well, and then could we set it in the 90s so that we don't owe all this 21st century, you know, weirdness.
That was a great touch. That was a great touch. So you could have little things about not using the computer. That's a running gag right. in the movie. It's like, why would you want to send an email?
Oh, it's great. It's great.
And also, you know, Adam, in the 90s, that was his real like rock star moment. And so it was cool to be able to sit with him and just get all the stories and hear about like, you know, the Mustache Cafe and what the improv was like back then and, you right. know, and discover what was really important to him. I mean, you were,
I had Rob Schneider on the show. We were saying the 90s is now a film category. Mm. It happened like that, yeah. you know.
It's crazy.
And the 90s was fun, you know. It was a good time.
It's so strange that the music and the movies, it's sort of like, Reality Bites. You guys might want to run it on TCM soon. You know what I mean?
Now, the other thing that I was going to say in terms of Adam that I don't think anybody ever notices, and I was going to ask you, is there a parallel? Because I see a parallel very much to Jerry Lewis, mm-hmm. to a kind of pathos.
First of all, I think he's as good. I think they're probably similar people. You know, Adam is a guy who, who really functions best when he's working. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So he works all the time. And if you want to know who he is, you look at his work. And I think, he's got this ability to like break your heart and make you laugh at stuff that you yourself wouldn't want to say out loud. You know, and he's a great absurdist clown, and he's also a great, he can deliver a subtle joke. I mean, and because the nature of who he is in the business, he gets to produce these things, especially with Netflix. So the movies become personal as well because he doesn't, owe all this. He doesn't have to do notes. So he doesn't have to do copious notes and really like work under the iron fist of a studio,
In that way, that's why I say, like, that's what it sort of reminded me of somebody like Jerry Lewis, mm-hmm. who, like, again, critics did not really like Jerry Lewis, but you look at mm-hmm. the movies and you're like, there's always two or three, like, really, really funny things. And again, I was saying to Jeff before we went on the air, somebody like, I really admire Adam Sandler, who works within the studio system. And you could say that he is an auteur because he makes his own movies. Mm-hmm. He puts all of his regulars in there. They do extraordinarily funny things. I mean, like Harvey Keitel in The Ridiculous Six. It blew me away. It was so stupid and funny.
I was writing Sandy around the time of The Ridiculous Six, and Netflix had originally passed on it because they thought it was going to be too sad. And Adam said to me, he said, and I had like a deal, you know what I mean? And then the deal like went away. So Adam said, if you want to keep writing it, you certainly don't have to. But if you want to keep writing it, I'll get it made. Just, let's get it going. And then 3 years later, we were able to do that. But I came down to Santa Fe to work on Ridiculous Six. Working with Harvey Keitel, kind of feeding him jokes, and
oh my god! All right, stop right there. What were you into? Were you? I mean, because he's funny. He is funny, and I think he looked. One of the things was again another great thing about Adam Sandler movies. People just look like they're having a blast, and Harvey Keitel looks so happy. But I can imagine a guy meeting Harvey Keitel and pitching him jokes a little scary.
Well, so I'm from New York and like the independent film world. I worked with Abel Ferrara. I was good friends with Victor Argo, so I saw Harvey do his eulogy at Vic's memorial. So I come from that world. You know what I mean? I know all the the stuff that comes with a guy like Harvey. So I had a choice, right? Either to kind of tiptoe around him or just to be like, we're on a clock. I'm supposed to make you funny. Like, let's go. Like, you don't know who I am. I'm in the movie, so I'm dressed like a dirty cowboy. Literally, I could be like an extra. I'm going like, I got something. But there was one thing where he was saying, "Ball, like, you don't have the balls to come over to me." And I said, I think it's funnier if you say huevos. I think it'll just be funnier the way his voice is. I was like, if you just go, you know, yeah, you don't have the huevos. So, but he couldn't say huevos. And like, it's one of those moments where, I'm an important part of the production, but I'm certainly not the most important part of the production. And now my single word joke is like, we're going like 19 takes. Oh. Because this man cannot say huevos correctly. And he's going like, you don't have the quap. What is it? Okay. You don't have the quap. The power. I don't know what it is.
And oh, it's God. Like,
but eventually he said it, and it's in the movie, and it's hilarious. But he was, I mean, that scene is one of my favorites. When he gets the severed head, and it's just,
it's crazy.
You get to do something that high. I mean, it's real Jerry Lewis, like Jacques Tati, like real physical, poetic comedy, you know? Mm-hmm.
The other thing, I want to switch back to Sandy Wexler. Kevin James almost steals the movie with, talk a little bit about that character. That blew me away. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in a movie. And I called up like three people and said, you have to see this thing. And you know what's great is that people go, really? And I'm like, no, I'm serious. You have to see this movie. It's you're really going to be shocked, because it's this slow thing that builds up to. And Kevin James, you can say he's like a ventriloquist. Mm-hmm.
And he's a ventriloquist who has a codependent relationship with his puppets. So he's very sweet and self-deprecating, and he can't really, he has no agency. He can't really assert himself. But his puppets are very aggressive and no problem expressing, their rage. And he takes them wherever he goes. He's kind of like a Marty character. You know, he wears a wife beater t-shirt at home and gets cereal on his face. And the scene where Adam has the stroke and Kevin ends up having to puppet Adam to get through the meeting, that was one of the first scenes I had.
It's brilliant. It's up there with any great Jerry Lewis. It's like, I was in astonishment. I loved the way it was shot. I mean, because again, comedy is, it's not only the way you write it, it's the way you shoot it, mm-hmm. and the way you cut it. I mean,
yeah.
So.
Well, Brill did a really good job, especially since, you know, he was also an LA 90s guy. And so he had a really great sensibility. And Adam, in terms of like a comedian, he knows, you know, he's not Eddie Murphy. He doesn't just give it up to the director. I mean, he understands the way jokes need to be played. And, you know, and we're on the set with him. So we're always like, you know, we're always collaborating to try to figure out what the best way to play the joke is. And, you know, so when you have a guy like that, who's like a 25-year veteran and has made probably more movies than I'll ever make, you know, two a year since he's like 22 or something. You know, he really has a good sense of, you know, how to block a physical comedy scene.
Yeah, the brilliance of that scene is they have to. Adam has had a stroke or a heart attack, and Kevin James finally has this big shot in front of Rob Reiner to get to do a television show, and so he, you know, Sandler's, he can't talk, so he. He uses him as a puppet, but the way it's shot, there's a long table, and Rob Reiner is at one end of the table, and they're at the other end. And it just keeps building to the point that you just, you know what I love about his movies too? It's sort of like you go, I'm not going to like this. This is not going to be funny. I get the joke. And then you're like, oh my God, that is really funny, but it's brilliantly staged.
It's so true. Yeah. And the thing I love, Paul, about, I mean, even what we're describing right now, in some ways is such a classic and pure distillation of comedy. It feels like your films and Adam's film have such a particular commitment to pure, unencumbered comedy. And I feel like that's not as common as it was even in the 90s, or like we talk about, you know, the Marx Brothers. And it just feels like I'm so grateful that there still is this movement in film to try to produce pure studio comedy films.
Yeah, I mean, my voice, I tend to like to make you laugh and cry. You know what I mean? I like Marty, and I like sort of the, that sort of old, Hollywood, and also kind of like, you know, Preston Sturges. I like the idea of a little bit of magic in a movie, and that it's going to give you a little bit of hope, maybe, that or catharsis, maybe, that you didn't have when you walked in. I think, though, I like big, so I want you to laugh big and cry big. And when you're dealing with somebody like Adam, you know, he can play both those levels probably better than anybody. There's not a lot of people out there that can do it. And yeah, you're right. There's no, like, there really aren't too many just balls out.
No, because there's, you know, when you think of like Mel Brooks in his prime, you know, and when I was a kid, and every year, you know, you get your Mel Brooks movie. But I was watching the movie, and as I was later again talking to people, I said, I promise you will laugh, like you will watch this thing, and it's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's made by people that understand that even, you know, when Adam has his heart attack, which is not necessarily, you know, you go, why is the heart attack funny? You know, it's just funny. It's like certain things are funny. And him having a heart attack before a big pitch, you know, is
the
funny.
The way he delivers that line, too, when Kevin says to him, but Sandy, you can't talk. And Adam goes, but you can. It's just the greatest.
It does.
Delivery.
Well, it has, again, it's got all those, you know, ideas of Hollywood, too, that work. So
right.
One of the things I was going to ask you, because, again, you were saying about, you know, critics not necessarily liking the movies. And I think I'm pretty smart and could sort of sometimes figure out why people may like things. And I have to say, like, I don't really understand the critics not liking the films. They're funny. They're just funny movies. And what I applaud is that they're actually well shot. I think a lot of the current crop of younger comedians make movies and they don't look very good. They just look crappy. Whereas Adam's movies have a certain artfulness,
a craft
about them. And Sandy Wexler, again, we're going to go in when we get to do our top 10, tons of great iconic locations in LA and beautifully shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we had like 77 locations or something. You know, yeah, like I love Judd's movies, but they're more joke based. So it's a lot of like shot, reverse shot, people standing on marks and just getting alts thrown at them and joke. And I think, you know, Adam,
McKay,
like, tell a story at a scale, you know, that requires real, you know, visual storytelling. So you're able to get something that's a little bit more, you know, cinematic. We screened the premiere we had at the Cinerama Dome. It was unbelievable.
Yes, I have a little confession about that. On the day of the premiere, I was across the street at Turner Classic Movies, had their little tiny piddly thing. I was like, I remember I was driving the car. I was like, wow, TCM is like really putting on the dog. That's the Adam Sandler movie. And so I was working on the red carpet, And Quincy Jones, true story, literally walked across the street and walked the wrong red carpet. He walked.
Hilarious.
He walked our red carpet. I introduced him, and he was like, "What? What? Oh, I'm in the wrong. I was supposed to be across the street."
Scene in Modern Romance where he goes to the wrong set.
Yes.
So he goes across the way, and I'm friends with a comedian named Wayne Fetterman. You know Wayne. Yeah. He's in the movie. So Wayne,
I never call him Wayne. It's the first time I ever called him that.
Oh, Fetterman. You call him Fetterman? Yeah. Well, Fetterman and I are very close friends, and he is always my go-to, you know, to go to the Turner Classic Movies. And he gave me a caveat. He said, I will go with you to the Turner Classic Movies, but you have to do me one favor. You have to go with me to the Sandy Wexler premiere. It's right across the street. So I was like, all right, what's the harm? You know, just walk across the street, right? So he did the Quincy Jones in reverse. He went over there. He came back to us. He's looking at his watch the whole time he's with me.
Right.
Halfway through the movie, you know, whatever we're watching, I think it was like, you know, Sound of Music. And he's like, okay, we got to go. The movie's over, you know. So I just go, well, what's the harm? First of all, the party was insane. You had this, I mean, it's like unbelievable. It was this huge party. And I went there and I was at the party and I was like, you know, what's the harm? It's free food, like Peter Fonda.
Oh, yeah.
The first thing that happens is that Adam Sandler walks up to me and he goes, oh, hey. Now, there's a whole Rob Schneider connection. I met him many years ago on Saturday Night Live. But he goes, so what'd you think of the movie? And I was like, oh, my God. And I said, it was great. I mean, I literally had no. And he looked at me like, you didn't like the movie. Because, like, I normally would have given all these details. Right. So I'm fessing up. I did not see the movie that night. I'm sorry.
So, Paul, it's your job to report how much
you
like
the right
loves
thing.
It.
That's the move. There's no, you know how it's like when somebody asks you how you doing on the street? You know? Nobody wants to know how you're doing. You just go, great, and you keep moving. It's the same thing.
Yes,
you like
really?
Go, congratulations. And then you just keep moving.
You know, Jeff Goldblum always says his go-to is, oh, it's genius. Genius.
I love that.
You always. Okay, let's get to our top 10 list. And we're all going to do our. I'm going to start with our number 10, my number 10. It was so tough to make all these changes. But we're going to go, I'm going to start with my number 10, as opposed to my number 1. My number 10 I chose is a film called Model Shop. Mm. Recently did a commentary for it. This is from 1967 by Jacques Demy. And the reason I picked it is that it's filmed by a foreigner, and this is basically his love affair with Los Angeles. This is also a big influence in the film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And as you know, going to L.A., you know, you can lose yourself in L.A., good and bad. Mm-hmm. I think when you first come here, you're like, where's the, I mean, I don't know how we did it with the Thomas Guide, like back in speaking of the 90s, right. But you know, you're driving, you're on the freeways and it has that aspect. And then it also has the inability to make a human connection, which the movie is very much about, a lonely guy. He's been drafted into the Vietnam War. He finds a woman, falls in love with her, and basically follows her, like up Sunset Drive, down Sunset. And it's a beautiful looking film. And that's why that became my number 10.
When I listen back to this podcast, I'll have that experience about my voice.
No, not at all. What's your number 4?
Wait, did I do 5? Is that when I lopped off?
Oh, I'm sorry, you're number 5. Apologies. Yeah, yes.
Yeah. My number 5 is Sullivan's Travels.
Mm. Ooh. I'm gonna cheat. I'm getting that might be my next one.
This is perfect. This is perfect.
We're on the same. Go ahead.
My favorite movie. I mean, Preston Sturges is obviously God. You know, it's not only just the overarching theme of it, which is that, you know, comedy heals. You don't have to, you know, be a Maisel's brother to, you know, affect change in the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But just the pace, the jokes, the way that Preston Sturges stages dialogue scenes, the charm of LA at that time, the way that Hollywood at that time, right, was sort of built by these immigrant Jews.
Yeah.
And everybody was still kind of from the street a little bit. You know, there was a toughness about it because there weren't that many generations of stars at that point.
Right.
So many people had come from either like a shtetl or a similar kind of neighborhood in New York. Then you had all these people coming out from the Midwest, but everybody kind of had this edge that I think Preston Sturges captures so beautifully with all the characters in that truck that are following him, the studio heads, Veronica Lake, and how Joel McRae is really the one who's just gotten so soft from being so successful. But there's all these kind of edgy, you know, smart mouthed, you know, very witty characters around him. It's just such a cool time to be in the movie business that I think is just depicted so elegantly.
Yeah. I also think it's such a great movie about a director. Mm. And there's a lot another movie on my list is primarily about a director. But it just that self-importance that you want to make a serious film. And so many of our great directors have gone down this road, especially comic directors, where they, you know, this is going to be my big, serious film.
Right.
Have you ever, I've had the experience, I worked with a director once, I won't mention the movie, but she really, and it wasn't, everyone's going to think it's Allison Anders, it's not Allison Anders, it was another movie, but the director was like, every day she kept saying, you know, this is my Raging Bull, and I was like, it's not, it's really, really not, and every scene we had to play as if it were incredibly important.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, you know, like, because obviously, you know, with your experience with Scorsese, like, I doubt that those guys thought they were making Raging Bull when they were.
Yeah.
It's always funny to see behind the curtain. Like, Darren Aronofsky is one of my best friends, and I think people think that he, like, sleeps upside down in a bat cave or something, you know? He's just like a nerdy guy, you know, that likes miso soup and stuff. Like, there's no, you know, like,
yeah,
he's not sitting around trying to, you know, conjure up demons and things. He's a guy. And there's something to that Joel McRae character where he's like, he is like narcissistically, you know, attached to this Lubitsch thing of like,
yeah,
you know, I got to beat Lubitsch, but this other thing of like, I got to be more than I am. I have to somehow be an important filmmaker, you know, which the quote unquote important filmmakers, I think, don't even consider themselves that and would rather like write for SNL if they could, you know?
Yeah. And it reminds me a little bit, you know, it's a dark film, but Barton Fink is in that same sort of, again, genre of you know, movies about Hollywood. What is yours, Jeff?
Well, we can hop, because I caught one, we can hop to Barton Fink. That's actually my number three.
Your number three is Barton Fink.
Yeah, so great timing. It's my favorite Coen Brothers movie. Actually, no, my favorite Coen Brothers movie has to be Fargo, because it was the first Coen Brothers movie I saw, and I do think it's their masterpiece. But I love movies about writers. I had Trumbo on this list, but I bumped it. But I think it's so interesting to see the experience of a writer rendered in film.
Yeah.
And Barton Fink is such a strange movie. And the Coen brothers, I think, and similarly to Tarantino, can make these big, weird choices, but keep it grounded in a way where a story matters so much and character matters so much.
Yeah.
And I think that performance in Barton Fink, there's just nothing really like it in the whole oeuvre of the Coen brothers movies. So I have to say, I love that film.
It's a beautiful looking film. It's a little dark for me. I enjoy it, but I mean, cause it's John Turturro and he can do no wrong.
Right.
You know, as far as I'm concerned. But, okay, well, I'm glad we got that one in there. My number four was Sullivan's Travels. My number three is The Bad and the Beautiful, Vincent Minnelli's lush, just a very lush story played over the top by Kirk Douglas. Again, it's megalomaniac, ruthless, but his redeeming quality is that he brought out the best in other people. Yeah. But he himself is a monster, which is another classic Hollywood thing. Like, you know, that we're all megalomaniac monsters, but we make pretty good pictures.
Pretty good pictures.
Yeah, we can all be Kirk Douglas on our you know, worst days.
Yeah.
That was one of the first movies I remember seeing it on TV. I was always fascinated by movies where you saw directing, where you saw like a director on a crane and the crane like came in and I was like, right, what the hell is that? That looks so cool, you know. And Vincent Minnelli sort of has that. And then Atlanta Turner is in it, sort of completely, you know, playing a Diane Barrymore type person. It's woven in that might be about Diane Barrymore, who's John Barrymore's daughter. And then also some people say it was based on David O. Selznick, which was another, you know. But Kirk Douglas is, when he says to the sweet girl who loves him, he wants to be with the prostitute, and he goes, "Sometimes I like to be cheap." It's like, well, Hollywood movies need over the top dialogue like that, you know.
That's great.
Yeah. So that was my number three. What would you have your number three handy?
My number three was George Cukor.
Yeah, we're neck and neck. That's my number two.
I love that movie so much. You can probably see the influence in Sandy Wexler.
Very much so. It's a love story. He builds her up, and very similar. A very always appealing theme.
You know? And the weirdly, you know, he. It's a weirdly ahead of its time kind of stylized movie. I mean, that scene where they're in the car and they're sort of getting to know you montage, and he does it in stills with you know, with ADR audio. Like, he does some really kind of just like neat groovy tricks in it that for a mainstream Hollywood movie of the time feel kind of feel really innovative and you know, sort of risky. It's hard to imagine a theater, you know, like the Ziegfeld, full of like squares watching that movie. And he's almost got this like Robert Frank kind of like, you know, 3-minute section in it. And that is really kind of bizarre and interesting to me. But those performances are,
oh my God,
ridiculous.
I love the long takes in it are, you know, of course, when she comes into the club and she's singing, you know, "The Man That Got Away Is Insane." It's just beautiful, him watching her. My particular favorite scene in the movie, again, I just find it very autobiographical. It looks almost like it's improv'd. And again, as I, being on film sets, I'm sure the same thing has happened to you. When she's talking to the head of the studio and she starts crying, her husband's an alcoholic. And then she has to come on and like, "Have a smile on your face."
Brutal.
And I think that all of us who are in show business have that thing where we've just received the worst possible news about something. Yep. And then it's showtime and you got to go on. So I think it captures that, you know.
Yeah, almost better than anything I've ever seen. James Mason is as an actor, he's almost impenetrable in terms of like, There's just something weird going on in there, and you can never really peg what he's thinking or feeling, or if he's in every performance he's ever given. How they always say an actor, you want to have a secret. Like, he's got like six secrets, and I never know. It's like kind of all subtext with him. I never really know what's going on with him until you find out what's going on with him, and especially in that one, I feel like there, you know, it's the slow build to who he really is kind of fascinating to watch.
Yeah, he anchors the movie. Plus, Jack Carson plays like just the biggest rat you ever. He's just so mean as the publicist, and I you know, that's another great character actor that I really like. Okay, yep. Stars Born. Here we go. My number one. It's probably going to be the same. Sunset Boulevard comes.
Wait, was that my number three or my number two?
My number two was Star is Born.
Okay, because I feel like I have two left.
Oh, okay, do your two.
Okay, my last two are Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, almost made my list.
And I think we all know, I mean, that's obviously a well-trodden road. But my number one is James L. Brooks' I'll Do Anything.
Wow. Okay.
My number one.
You have stumped me. Really?
Have you not seen it?
I have seen it. In fact, I even visited that set. Anything. I'm going to rewatch it.
And Alan Covert is the only other guy that I know is as passionate about this movie as I am.
Wow.
But it is, there's something. It touches on every part of this business in such a human, in that James L. Brooks, like, accessible, kind of heightened, anxious, almost embarrassingly human way. You know, it's basically about Nick Nolte's sort of ex-wife drops off their daughter at his front door, and he's this kind of struggling actor. He had like one great scene in Apocalypse Now, and now it's 1990, and he's, you know, still trying to do it, and he's hugely talented, but the game is winning. And he takes this job as an assistant for Albert Brooks, who plays the, you know, hotshot studio executive who has this kind of tense, weird relationship with Julie Kavner, who's the, you know, she's the woman that does the market research, you know, the cards at the screen. And he's a broken narcissist, but she sees something in him, so she's trying to fix him, but he can't be fixed. And in the meantime, the kid gets discovered as a, you know, like a Punky Brewster, Soleil Moonfry sort of, you know, hot actor. And now Nick Nolte's got to deal with the fact that his kid is a hugely talented mini narcissist. Nick Nolte becomes involved with this executive who works for Albert Brooks. It's just all of it kind of comes together. And the two great scenes in it are, one, not to ruin it, but where the woman that Jolie Richardson, the woman that that Nick Nolte is seeing,
right?
She slept with him, and now she's in a meeting with Albert Brooks, her boss, and two other executives, deciding whether or not to cast Nick Nolte in this film they're producing.
Right.
And Albert Brooks goes around the room and he goes, is he sexy? Would you sleep with him? And the one guy goes, no. And the other guy goes, no. And the other girl goes, no. And then it gets to her, and she has slept with him, and she says, no. And that's this business. She couldn't go, you know what I mean? She didn't have the balls to stand up and go, not only would I did, and he'd be great in this movie. And and the other great scene is where at the very end, Albert Brooks says, I talked to Oliver Stone. It was Platoon that Nolte was in. He goes, I talked to Oliver Stone. He remembers you from Platoon. He wants you to be in his new movie. You know, it's like a character. He's got like 7-8 lines. You know, it's not a big character. But and Nolte goes, best part in the picture.
That's what you always have to say. Okay, we've seen you. We're going to get a lot of arguments about that. I'll do anything. Yes. I'm going to knocks out Sunset Boulevard,
which is yours,
which was mine,
which is an amazing pick.
And your number one is.
I hope I'm not not cheating with this one, but I said All About Eve, which is, it's a movie about entertainment.
It's about New York. It's about Broadway.
That's true. It is about
Broadway.
Get
out of the studio.
Yeah, I know that might not count, but I think in the way that it's addressing, similarly to The Star, the themes of Hollywood, and I think because it's probably my favorite movie, I'm just trying to shoehorn it into this category. But I, as someone who loves good writing, I do think that's one of the best screenplays that's ever been written. It's so funny, but also so tragic. Again, I love when a film can like really deeply explore themes of tragedy and sadness, but lift them with humor or with intrigue or really interesting genre elements. And I just, the performances and All About Eve, and again, thematically, the way it's addressing ageism and, you know, the tragedy of a lost career, which I think is so prescient in Hollywood films. I think I'm shoehorning it in there, but it is, because it's one of my favorite movies, I'm going to say it's also my favorite Hollywood movie.
Well, if you like that, then you'll like The Star.
I'm excited to watch it. Yeah.
Because, you know, after she did All About Eve, it was sort of like every movie was a degradation, you know, went one degree down from Margot Channing.
Yeah.
And The Star is like the bottom of the barrel, you know, sort of, again, the bottom of the barrel. I like The Star.
It's, yeah.
You know, and there's so many we didn't get to. The Last Tycoon, Day for Night, Barefoot Contessa, The Carpetbaggers.
In a Lonely Place.
Yeah, For Your Consideration, Stuntman. Almost put Modern Romance, too, on there.
Ooh, yeah.
A great, you know, we should just do a show devoted to Albert Brooks.
And then have some editors on.
That's a great idea. We probably will. I love that.
We talk to that. Okay, Paul. Well, this has been fantastic. Yeah. What are you going to say? Did I interrupt you? What?
No, I was saying thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you. It's just been an honor. And when you finally come out in L.A., please come by the studio and we can do this again and talk about other things.
This has been really great. And, you know, Ileana, I feel like you're a very important force in, you know, in this world we're in.
Thank you.
Trying to, you know, in preserving the history of it and the work that you're doing and the work that you have done. And you're very kind and benevolent and, necessarily irreverent force in movies, show business and all of it.
So. Oh, thank you. Plus, I'm at the age I don't really care anymore. So I'm telling all the stories, who is nice to me and who is mean and. You know, all the good audition stories, bad audition stories. Who snubbed me? You know, it's all going to come out one story at a time.
Exactly.
And we didn't even get to talk about Queens. What part of Queens are you from? Because I spent a lot.
I grew up like 168th Horace Harding. They call it Fresh Meadows.
Uh huh.
They were nothing is fresh, and there are no meadows. And I went to Francis Lewis High School.
Oh, my God. Yes, my grandparents live right near Francis Lewis Boulevard. I think my uncle went there.
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's where I.
Wait, was their mascot the Bulldog?
No, we were so rinky-dink in terms of our teams and stuff because everybody was, you know, into, like, graffiti and drugs and things. But, I think our mascot was like a spray paint.
Okay, that's a much better joke. Did you go to Gert's department store? That's where my grandparents, that's where my grandma.
No, we used to go, my mother used to take us to the Lower East Side.
Oh.
To like Canal Street.
That was too far for my grandmother.
But that's like where the deals were, yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I was going into the back of some dusty store with some, you know, Bernie Sanders looking guy selling us socks.
Oh my goodness. All right, Paul. Well, thank you so much. Everybody should take a look at so many of the movies we've recommended. And, you know, Adam Sandler, 100% Fresh, which is on right now, is just a fantastic comedy special with a lot of music. And I'm a sucker for music, of course, anything with funny songs and that the tribute to Chris Farley at the end, of course, incredibly touching.
Yeah, me and Adam and a guy named Dan Bula wrote that. And Dan Bula wrote a lot of that music. And he's writing on SNL now. And he also did a lot of work on Sandy Wexler. And he's a, I should mention him, he's a great comedy writer. yeah, and the two of us sat there with Adam and got all those Farley stories and put that song together. Mm. And that was like a huge honor to be a part of that. It was very, very, like, just kind of indescribable.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks so much for being part of our first show.
Yes, I feel honored, privileged, and this was a lot of fun.
Oh, well, thanks, Paul. All right, we'll talk to you soon. Everyone, thanks for a great show. Thank you, Jeff.
It's my pleasure, Leanna. This is I had so much fun producing you for years that it's, like, so fun for me to be on the panel.
He produced me.
Yes. I know, it does sound funny. I was, you know, in the booth watching as a fan, and here I am on the panel with you. So
and
it's
laughing. We'll be talking, continuing the talk.
And absolutely.
If everybody out there is screaming that we didn't get to their favorite movie, just hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, any of our wonderful options.
Absolutely. And you can comment down below in this video. We had a lot of people in the chat today making amazing recommendations. So I want to know that I see you guys. A lot of amazing. Oh, Adaptation. That's a great one. Talking Charlie Kaufman. There's so many films. So just let us know down in the comments below.
Yes.
And Ileana, of course, we're back. This is the film scene with Ileana Douglas.
We end our show and say everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and the end. This is the end of our show for today. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.
So what's yours?
I struggled with Model Shop too. It was definitely on my. It was on and off the list for a while. The player is number 10. Mm.
Yeah, that's a good one. That opening shot.
The reason why it's so far down on the list, I think, is because it's an obvious choice.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
But to me, people always describe it as like, you know, that's the real dirt on what Hollywood is like. It's not, but it's almost like a fantasy. It's almost like porn for people who work in Hollywood.
You know, right.
It's what they wish they were doing. Mm-hmm. You know, the tropes of the whodunit genre kind of find their way into the movie, and everybody's dressed in, you know, these sort of double-breasted Armani suits from that era, and there's kind of like a prom aspect to it for Hollywood people, and I like the artifice of that. It's almost like a Brian De Palma-esque kind of a thing, which I kind of dig.
And lots of great cameos, which is another Hollywood movie trope, you know.
Yeah, you know, the Buck Henry pitching The Graduate, who is one of the funniest 6 seconds in a movie. It's just that's just sort of a one-off bit. Vincent D'Onofrio in it. There's just a lot of great little pieces to it. Lyle Lovett in it.
Lyle Lovett, awesome. Where's Lyle Lovett?
Yeah, it's been a minute.
I'm going to do a top 10 about where, and then I'm just fill in the blank.
Where's X? I love that.
Where's Lyle Lovett these days?
That's great.
All right, Jeff, what's your 10?
You know, I actually only made 5.
Oh, okay.
So I will,
jump in at 5?
I'll jump in at 5, yeah.
All right, okay.
I want to let the scholars hop in, and then I'll hop in as well.
Okay, this was my on the list, off the list, on the list, off the list, but I put it on there, and what it knocked off was a movie that I also really love, which is The Big Knife. Mm-hmm. I knocked that one off. That's a black and white movie. Yeah, Clifford Odets, Jack Palance. Yeah,
I saw it on Broadway. My buddy Bobby did it. Bobby Cannavale did it on Broadway.
Oh, he did.
And it was bananas. I mean, it was just fantastic. It didn't run for that long, but it was the play was really incredible. Jack Palance, right, in the movie?
Yeah, Jack Palance. It's just, and it's just brutal. And again, it's got all these, you know, Rod Steiger. It's the greatest Rod Steiger over the top performance of all time. And
well, maybe the loved one. I would pick the loved one might at least match it.
But I took it off and I replaced it with "Don't Get Mad at Me," La La Land. But we can all argue about it. We can all argue about it. I put it on there. It was again. I had it on. I had it off. I just think, as a testament, for two reasons. I think the opening scene is incredible and staged in an incredible way. I love the colors. He was a big fan of Jacques Demy and the, you know, Umbrellas of Cherbourg and the colors of that. And I think that I actually think it did deserve to win an Oscar. I'm going with the controversy.
It's fair.
Wow.
It's your show.
I think there was something fishy happened that year with Warren Beatty. And because it seemed odd that Moonlight won the best picture. But I put La La Land on because there's so many great scenes of L.A. and the, you know. And
it is cool. That movie's very special in the way that it is a modern film. Like, it definitely has the DNA of a movie that gets made now, but it's such an affectionate look at how classic Hollywood films were made. Even, you know, the titling they use after that first sequence plays to old films. So it is in the same way that Tarantino's Once Upon a Time, I think, is such an impassioned love letter to the city. This is Damien Chazelle's version of that in the same way.
Yeah. I also think that the audition scene is one of the great, you know, scenes. I like that. And then it's got the crazy cameos with, like, John Legend.
Mm.
I you know, things like that. I was like the crazy cameo in the movie. That was the weak part of the movie. That band
didn't love it.
That he was in. What's your number nine?
My number nine is Hal Needham's Hooper.
Oh yes, couple people on Twitter mentioned that one. Yeah, about stuntmen.
Yeah, Hooper's great. Hooper is Hal Needham directed it. Hal Needham, the, you know, probably greatest stuntman that ever lived. I think he broke something like, I don't know how many bones we have in our body, but I think he broke all of them. And, you know, it's like a love letter to that contingent of what we do. I mean, you've worked on your whole life. Like, you know, that's a community.
Yeah.
In the system that's set. You know, and you can either get in and fraternize or they don't like you, you're not getting in. And, you know, they're like, they're sort of the cowboy, female cowboys, whatever you call it, you know, they are the man of the craft. And that movie, J. Michael Vincent plays like the young, you know, scientific kind of, let's do these stunts, you know, where we can minimize the risk, to Burt Reynolds kind of, you know, like passionate, and the whole thing is the risk and the glory of, you know, going out and just leaping without looking. And, you know, it becomes this sort of battle between them to, it's a little bit in the sense of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, the old guard meeting the new guard, and then they find kind of a happy middle. And then there's that great scene with the like the rocket powered Trans Am, where J. Michael Vincent is driving it and Burt Reynolds is riding shotgun, and kind of it gets to that moment where they've got to jump that cliff, and J. Michael Vincent is like, there's no safe way to do this, and Burt Reynolds says, well, that's the deal, baby, you got to just punch it and go, which is a great metaphor for coming to Hollywood. You know, you got to punch it and go sometimes, you know.
Oh man, you're telling me. I love, that's another sort of Hollywood movie thing, is when they're on set. Now, whenever usually they're in a movie, there's usually Roman centurions that have to go by. Is that the go-to?
Sword and sandals, right? That's all you need.
Or showgirls. Yeah. Two showgirls.
Or aliens, I think, too.
Oh, yeah, aliens they use a lot. I've
never seen a movie about centurions that wasn't, like, entirely made in a computer.
It's true.
Now you got to see guy walking by, and he's like, I promise this is 100 centurions.
It's a green tennis ball.
Okay, my number eight is Hollywoodland. I wanted to, I brought this up because I thought it was a kind of an undiscovered classic, really about the underbelly of Hollywood and this Hollywood fixer named Eddie Mannix. And
Adrian Brody?
Yes, Adrian Brody investigating the murder of George Reeves. And this was sort of a comeback movie for Ben Affleck.
Well, this is post Gigli, right? So he needed a
he needed an indie.
I really like Ben Affleck in this movie. It's funny, candidly, he can be hit or miss for me. I sometimes prefer him behind the camera as to him in front of the camera, but I really do like him in this role, and I think he's very well cast for it to play George Reeves.
I think it was sort of perfect timing for him. Another thing in Hollywood movies, you know, the rise and fall is always like a good metaphor in Hollywood. In Hollywood films. And I don't know if you know about Eddie Mannix, but he was this Hollywood fixer. And I think there's all sorts of unsolved murders and sham marriages. And there are like things swirl around him. There was like he forced Van Johnson to marry his best friend. And, you know, I mean, like, all you know, like, I have good news for you, Van. You're marrying tomorrow. Here's the woman you're marrying. You know, I mean, we talk about the glory days of Hollywood, but there are some things that seem like they're pretty scary. And that movie reflects it.
Yeah.
Also, if you name your kid Eddie Mannix, like, you're not getting a doctor.
You know what I mean? Fair. Like,
buy him a fedora and an overcoat.
Oh, and another thing about Eddie Mannix is the movie Hail Caesar is a comic retelling of the Eddie Mannix story.
I love that.
Yeah, so it's sort of, I got a twofer in there.
Absolutely.
Without really, so what is, let's hear your number eight.
My number eight is Star 80.
Really? Okay. Star, that is, talk about dark. That is like
a dark one, but I feel like it's, and that's the sort of the dark one I chose, except for maybe there's one more or two more. But it's Fosse.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's coming from the sauce, from the source. From sauce.
Yes.
You know, it's there's a sense of I know what I'm talking about in that one. And also, you know, it's kind of the story of what happens when all that, when toxic people or mentally ill people or people who are ill equipped for the pressure cooker arrive in that town.
Yes.
And, you know, and get wrapped up in the wrong way. You know, and the sort of desperation and impatience and, you know, wrongheaded goals and then how that can manifest itself in some dark stuff. But the Playboy Mansion of it all and the Bogdanovich of it all, I feel like...
You're right. It's a Hollywood story. That's a classic.
Yeah.
A modern... And I think that everyone in Hollywood, I don't know if you feel this way, Paul, but I don't feel this way now, but... Back in the 90s, a couple times, like, you'd be at a party and would be like, ooh, I don't, this is not good. Usually it was up in the hills. Like, you'd find yourself late at night. We didn't have Uber then.
Right.
But you'd think, like, ooh, it's, I think I want to leave, you know? It's not a, there is a seamy...
Yeah.
Hollywood at night is a little scary for me.
LA's so spread out.
It's not like New York.
Yeah.
You can't just go, and just, you know, get out of there and, you know,
right.
Blocks and suddenly, you know, you're in a different neighborhood. You are stuck wherever you are. And it can be terrifying.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
Well, now that makes me really want to re-see that film, except the ending is.
It's really. I think it's worth a rewatch.
The ending is so dark. Okay, speaking of dark films, my number seven, L.A. Confidential, I picked just, again, the locations of Los Angeles, the performance of Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce, like, right out of Australia. And I just thought it was an incredible movie. Also, just the look of the film, I think it captured, you know, from the mid-century modern houses down in Silver Lake to the bungalows. And again, it's that cross section of Hollywood and corruption, you know, when things that happen that cross over with the police. And L.A. was really, again, back in the day, you know, kind of a scary place at night. So I don't know if you've
seen it. Danny DeVito is one of my favorite actors and directors. And his performance in that movie is one of his best.
Yes, I think so. And also, again, with the, you know, with L.A., with the Confidential magazine and how influential that was. And they, again, they ruined people's careers. They ruined Tab Hunter's career.
Right.
Completely. They literally destroyed his career. They tried to destroy Maureen O'Hara's career, and she sued them.
The reason that movie works so well, too, is because it works as a genre film as well as a film about Hollywood. It's a great thriller no matter where it's set. You know, you have the DNA of a really well-made movie, and the Hollywood components complement the tone in the story so well.
I like the tone of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole tone, the whole look of the film. Kim Basinger is in the movie. Yeah. It was perfect.
That big fight scene down in the jail in the holding cell is horrifying scene. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it was scary when you find out the farmer from Babe, like the bad guy. That freaked me out. But it's like a history of Hollywood. That's what I, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
That was my dark pick. So yours was L.A. Okay, number six. I felt bad. This should have been almost higher on the list, but it's so good. Ed Wood. I picked Ed Wood.
That's my number six, too.
It is? Oh, look at that. Simpatico. Yeah.
It's definitely one of Tim Burton's best movies. I personally, just for personal reasons, Big Fish is my favorite Tim Burton movie, and I know that movie gets mixed reviews, but Ed Wood, if we're talking about Damien Chazelle loving Hollywood through La La Land, and we're talking about Tarantino loving Hollywood through Once Upon a Time, this is Tim Burton's, just everything about it is just such a passionate plea as to why filmmaking is such a beautiful art form.
Right. I think Johnny Depp just gives an inspired, wacky performance.
I think when he started, I think people really treated him like the artist that he is. And then I think when the movie star sort of part of his life, the pirate part, started to happen, I think people kind of lost sight of that. And that now his personal life is sort of the thing, and he looks very strange, and that happens to people. But that guy is like a ballet dancer. I mean, he's the Baryshnikov performing on screen. That performance is like, it's so elegant and strange and subtle, but, you know, it's in a broad context. I don't know. And then Martin Landau, that's the greatest thing he's ever done.
Yeah, Martin Landau's Bela Lugosi is, again, that's one of those movies, too. Certain Hollywood movies that where I have been that person where it's late at night and the director, you're doing something for like $1.98. They want you to fight with the octopus, and you just are like, I'm gonna have to get in my car and go home and go back to my trailer. And you know, like you go to acting school and you have all these dreams and you want to do important movies, and then you know you find yourself like going, I think they have a leaf blower in my face, and I'm supposed to be pretending I'm on a motorboat. Okay. And so
when Ed Wood asks Bela Lugosi, when he says, "What do you drink it, Bella?" And Bella goes, "Formaldehyde." One of the lines in the movie ever.
Yeah, it just is. Again, it's a movie that's made clearly by people who love movies. And one of the screenwriters is one of our good friends here, Larry Karaszewski, who is making a movie about Hollywood, Dolomite, with Eddie Murphy. So
it's gonna be good.
Yeah, that's gonna be another Hollywood movie that we could talk about. Plus, it's got Bill Murray in it.
Which also, friend of the show, Mitch Glazer, was on. So if you want some good Bill Murray stories, definitely check out our Mitch Glazer episode.
It's a great one. That would be a that would be a good one. Okay, my so Jeff, let's hear your number five.
All right, so I'm actually going to swap out my number five and bump it up because I realized during this, I don't know if it counts, but my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie is Boogie Nights, and that is kind of about Hollywood, right? Are we going to count that as an industry movie? It's about the Valley.
Yeah, it is about the Valley. You could say it's a Hollywood movie.
It's a Hollywood movie. If we're talking about the underbelly of Hollywood, that's how I can justify it. But Paul Thomas Anderson, I have a complicated relationship with. Some of his movies I think are masterpieces. Some of them I kind of struggle with. But I think Boogie Nights, to me, is the perfect distillation of what makes Paul Thomas Anderson great. It's a huge ensemble, right? He's one of the few directors who can really master an ensemble.
Right.
But I think each character has paid so much attention in that movie. No one expected Mark Wahlberg to turn in the performance he did for that film. And Boogie Nights somehow manages to have such a sense of fun and joy, but also be so tragic at the same time. I think it's really, really hard to do that. And that experience to me can sometimes feel like exactly what LA is. So,
well, it also has Burt Reynolds in it, which again, classic movies about all Hollywood always have like the old endearing movie, you know, Martin Landau and Ed Wood, Burt Reynolds and Boogie Nights. You know, there are certain things we want that comeback. We want that them to get their Academy Award, although it didn't happen with Burt Reynolds.
Did not.
I think that he definitely could have gotten this Academy Award. I think from Paul's perspective, like, he didn't really participate in that process. You know what I mean? I think something happened between wrapping that movie and its release, and he decided he was sort of disavowing it.
Right. He thought I was like the worst.
like the opposite of the instincts that he should have had, but
yeah,
I always have the opposite. I think something is going to be amazing, and then I see it, and I go, "That is not the movie I made. What happened?"
I thought The Cobbler was going to be a hit. I was like, you know, let's go. And then Peter Travers called it a toxic smear of curdled whimsy, and I went, "Okay,
Peter,
we can disagree."
Now, do you ever see, now to me, as John Milius once said to me, no grudge is too small. When you run into these people, now I know it, I know the name of every person who's ever said anything negative about me.
Yeah, I have a list.
In print, Peter Bart. So who is your person?
Travers is one of them. I've never run into the guy. I'm sure he's a wonderful guy. I wish him all
the best. No, probably not. He's probably not.
Yeah. But like, as a human man, I wish no harm on him. I'm not Vincent Gallo. You know, I'm like, I hope he lives a long and happy life. But like, whenever I see him doing that like thing, he has a popcorn show or something where he's like, movies, and you're so great, Dustin Hoffman. And I'm just kind of like, yeah, you know, you're like a glorified. He's just, there's a, he's not a proper critic. And to take us, we were a small movie. We were an $8 million movie, independent, made in New York. And to take that movie and write a one sentence review of it where all the adjectives could like describe vomit, you know what I mean? It's like, it's just so, who are you? What have you ever done? Like, you've never taken a swing. You've never been like, Hooper and Ski, you know, flying off that cliff, not knowing if you were going to reach the other side. Just leave us alone, man. Like, if you don't want to help us, fine, but don't hurt us.
Well, you know, what's interesting about the movie is that what I was thinking is that if the Coen brothers had directed it, they would have called it a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. As I was watching the movie, I thought, this is kind of like a Coen brothers film. It's got
You know, what I told Tom McCarthy was, I was like, dude, if we would have just made this movie in French, we would have won we would have won Best Foreign Film.
I agree. I agree. I think there was, there's always, you know, it's the, is this just my own thing, but does Adam Sandler have a different degree of performance when he's acting in other films than when he's acting in his own films?
Yeah, it's a very different thing. That's why, you know, I met him because we cast him in that movie. So he showed up as an actor. So he wasn't a producer. He wasn't a writer. He completely relinquished all control.
Yeah.
If I came up to him with a note, he didn't really, you know, it wasn't like he was considering it. He just kind of took it because I was the writer on the movie. You know, so he really, when he's working with like with us on that or PTA or the Softies or whoever, you know, he really just sort of shows up as, you know, he's a movie star. There's a lot going on with that, but he's there to perform and nothing else. You know what I mean? So it's an interesting color that he has, you know, when he's doing stuff like that.
Well, it's interesting. If people are going to watch it, what I might do is watch the special, because there's a lot of insights about that I learned about Adam and his relationship with his own father and that come out very much in The Cobbler. And I thought it was very moving. That was, for me, was the most moving part of the film, was that storyline. And it was really sad, and it was really touching. And then he and Dustin Hoffman worked in another film together also, right?
Yeah, Noah Baumbach's movie.
Yeah.
The Meyerowitz stories. When we were doing that scene in the shoe basement where he has that sort of, you know, reconciliation moment with his father, we went to lunch and realized we hadn't gotten it. And so after lunch, we came back and we sort of jiggered where we were going to put the camera and stuff. And then Dustin, when we were on Adam, Dustin just started like going at Adam with all of this sort of, you know, having a lot of insight about Adam's relationship with his father, and just kept feeding Adam all this really potent stuff. Like,
yeah,
he's here with us, you know. I know you miss him. It's not your fault. Da, 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 all this stuff. Wow. And that's what got Adam to really give us that authentic and sort of deep stuff that he was doing. And then, you know, we turned around on Dustin and he just said the lines, but that was intense.
Yeah. The movie has an undercurrent that you can feel of profound sadness. That I found really, really interesting. And Steve Buscemi is, he can do no, I mean, he and John Turturro in my book.
I don't even understand how you become those guys. I mean, you've worked with Buscemi, right?
I've worked with both. I've worked with Steve in a couple films and John in a couple films, and they're flawless. They are.
The technical proficiency.
I know.
Coupled with, like, they're like Van Morrison. They're right on the beat.
Yeah,
but when it's time to get off the beat, they're behind it. If you know what I mean, whatever it is, it's a combination of like unexpected, like complete freedom with like a total technical proficiency and intense craft. I don't know. It's just, and they work like dogs, and it's baffling. I work with Turturro for a day, but Buscemi I know, and he's just an incredible, incredible guy.
Yeah, and he's great in the film. So I think more people should see that film. I'd be curious to have
Netflix. Once it got to Netflix, it started to sort of globally started to catch on, and people started to see it. Turturro told me that the only man he ever met that he thought might be able to kill him with his bare hands was Woody Allen.
Wow.
Yes. That's funny. Oh, my God. Okay, I'm getting to my number five. This is a sort of obscure movie. It's a little out there again. It's called The Star with Bette Davis. The reason I picked this movie, again, it's got some elements of it that are campy. At one point, she goes on an alcoholic drive through Hollywood with her Academy Award and runs and drives drunk over Mitzi Gaynor's lawn. I mean, so it's got certain things that are over the top. But I thought that the idea, because I've seen it so many times, you know, in Hollywood, the idea of, you know, when an actress gets to a certain age and how making that bridge to character parts, and it's impossible for, and there's a scene that is so poignant where she finally gets an audition and she goes in the dressing room and she wipes off all the hag makeup and she fixes up her hair. Mom. And she's supposed to be like a scullery maid, and instead she comes back and she's doing Bette Davis' Cabin in the Cotton, and you know, And it's and then she see, and you'd think, okay, that's enough, but she sees herself, which is one of these things, which is also in Once Upon a Time in America, actress watching herself on screen. Bette Davis watches herself as this character on screen and breaks down crying and runs out. And I think that all of us who are in show business have had that moment where you go, you know what? I don't know if it's better lighting or something needs to happen, you know. But that's my movie, The Star.